Side 8, The Robots of Dawn. Continuing on page 292. "You know them both, I see," said Bailey.
"By reputation only. I actually see them," I, a roboticist, was about to say, "in the flesh. I actually see them physically for the first time now, although I saw Daniil portrayed by an actor in that hyperwave show."
"Everyone in all the worlds has apparently seen that hyperwave show," said Bailey glumly. "It makes my life as a real and limited individual difficult."
"Not with me," said Amadeiro, his smile broadening. "I assure you, I did not take your fictional representation with any seriousness whatever. I assumed you were limited in real life, and so you are, or you would not have indulged so freely in unwarranted accusations on Aurora."
"Dr. Amadeiro," said Bailey, "I assure you, I was making no formal accusations. I was merely pursuing an investigation and considering possibilities."
"Don't misunderstand me," said Amadeiro with sudden earnestness. "I don't blame you. I am sure that you were behaving perfectly by Earth standards. It is just that you are up against Auroran standards now. We treasure reputation with unbelievable intensity."
"If that were so, Dr. Amadeiro, then haven't you and other globalists been slandering Dr. Fastolf with suspicion to a far greater extent than any small thing I have done?"
"Quite true," agreed Amadeiro. "But I am an eminent Auroran and have a certain influence, while you are an Earthman and have no influence whatever. That is most unfair, I admit, and I deplore it, but that is the way the worlds are. What can we do? Besides, the accusation against Fastolf can be maintained and will be maintained, and slander isn't slander when it is the truth. Your mistake was to make accusations that simply can't be maintained. I'm sure you must admit that neither Mr. Gramianus nor Dr. Vasily Aliena, nor both together, could possibly have disabled poor Jander."
"I did not formally accuse either."
"Perhaps not. But you can't hide behind the word formally on Aurora. It's too bad Fastolf didn't warn you of this when he brought you in to take up this investigation. This, as it now is, I'm afraid, ill-fated investigation."
Bailey felt the corner of his mouth twitch as he thought that Fastolf might indeed have warned him. He said, "Am I to get a hearing in the matter, or is it all settled?"
"Of course you will get a hearing before being condemned. We are not barbarians here on Aurora. The chairman will consider the memo I have sent him, together with my own suggestions in the matter. He will probably consult Fastolf as the other party intimately concerned, and then arrange to meet with all three of us, perhaps tomorrow. Some decision might be reached then, or later, and it would be ratified by the full legislature. All due process of law will be followed, I assure you."
"The letter of the law will be followed, no doubt. But what if the chairman has already made up his mind? What if nothing I say will be accepted, and what if the legislature simply rubber-stamps a foregone decision? Is that possible?" Amadeiro did not exactly smile at that, but he seemed subtly amused.
"You are a realist, Mr. Bailey. I am pleased with that. People who dream of justice are so apt to be disappointed, and they are usually such wonderful people that one hates to see that happen."
Amadeiro's glance fixed itself on Daniil again.
"A remarkable job, this humaniform robot," he said. "It is astonishing how close to his vest Fastolf has kept things. And it is a shame that Jander was lost. There Fastolf did the unforgivable."
"Dr. Fastolf, sir, denies that he was in any way implicated."
"Yes, Mr. Bailey, of course he would. Does he say that I am implicated? Or is my implication entirely your own idea?"
Bailey said deliberately, "I have no such idea. I merely wish to question you on the matter. As for Dr. Fastolf, he is not a candidate for one of your accusations of slander. He is certain you have had nothing to do with what happened to Jander, because he is quite certain you lack the knowledge and capacity to immobilize a humaniform robot." If Bailey hoped to stir things up in that manner, he failed. Amadeiro accepted the slur with no loss of good humor and said,
"In that, he is right, Mr. Bailey. Sufficient ability is not to be found in any roboticist, alive or dead, except for Fastolf himself. Isn't that what he says, our modest master of masters?"
"Yes, he does."
"Then whatever does he say happened to Jander, I wonder?"
"A random event, purely chance."
Amadeiro laughed. "Has he calculated the probability of such a random event?"
"Yes, Master Roboticist. Yet even an extremely unlikely chance might happen, especially if there were incidents that bettered the odds."
"Such as what?"
"That is what I am hoping to find out. Since you have already arranged to have me thrown off the planet, do you now intend to forestall any questioning of yourself? Or may I continue my investigation until such time as my activity in that respect is legally ended? Before you answer, Dr. Amadeiro, please consider that the investigation has not as yet been legally ended, and in any hearing that may come up, whether tomorrow or later, I will be able to accuse you of refusing to answer my questions if you should insist on now ending this interview. That might influence the chairman in his decision.
It would not, my dear Mr. Bailey. Don't imagine you can in any way interfere with me. However, you may interview me for as long as you wish. I will cooperate fully with you, if only to enjoy the spectacle of the good Fastolf trying uselessly to disentangle himself from his unfortunate deed. I am not extraordinarily vindictive, Mr. Bailey, but the fact that Jander was Fastolf's own creation does not give him the right to destroy it.
Bailey said, "It is not legally established that this is what he has done, so that what you have just said is at least potentially slander. Let us put that to one side, therefore, and get on with this interview. I need information. I will ask my questions briefly and directly, and if you answer in the same way, this interview may be completed quickly."
"No, Mr. Bailey. It is not you who will set the conditions for this interview," said Amadeiro. "I take it that one or both of your robots is equipped to record our conversation in full."
"I believe so."
"I know so. I have a recording device of my own as well. Don't think, my good Mr. Bailey, that you will lead me through a jungle of short answers to something that will serve Fastolf's purpose. I will answer as I choose and make certain I am not misinterpreted, and my own recording will help me make it certain that I am not misinterpreted."
Now, for the first time, there was the suggestion of the wolf behind Amadeiro's attitude of friendliness. "Very well, then, but if your answers are deliberately long-winded and evasive, that too will show up in the recording."
"Obviously."
"With that understood, may I have a glass of water to begin with?"
"Absolutely. Giscard, will you oblige Mr. Bailey?"
Giscard was out of his niche at once. There was the inevitable tinkle of ice at the bar at one end of the room, and a tall glass of water was on the desk immediately before Bailey. Bailey said, "Thank you, Giscard," and waited for him to move back into his niche. He said, "Dr. Amadeiro, am I correct in considering you the head of the Robotics Institute?"
"Yes, you are."
"And its founder?"
"Correct. You see, I answer briefly."
"How long has it been in existence?"
"As a concept, decades. I have been gathering like-minded people for at least 15 years. Permission was obtained from the legislature 12 years ago. Building began 9 years ago, and active work began 6 years ago. In its present completed form, the Institute is 2 years old, and there are long-range plans for further expansion eventually." "There you have a long answer, sir, but presented reasonably concisely."
"Why did you find it necessary to set up the Institute?"
"Ah, Mr. Bailey, here you surely expect nothing but a long-winded answer."
"As you please, sir."
At this point, a robot brought in a tray of small sandwiches and still smaller pastries, none of which were familiar to Bailey. He tried a sandwich and found it crunchy and not exactly unpleasant, but odd enough for him to finish it only with an effort. He washed it down with what was left of his water. Amadeiro watched with a kind of gentle amusement and said,
"You must understand, Mr. Bailey, that we Aurorans are unusual people. So are spacers generally, but I speak of Aurorans in particular now. We are descended from Earth people, something most of us do not willingly think about, but we are self-selected."
"What does that mean, sir?"
"Earth people have long lived on an increasingly crowded planet and have drawn together into still more crowded cities that finally became the beehives and anthills you call cities with a capital C. What kind of Earth people, then, would leave Earth and go to other worlds that are empty and hostile so that they might build new societies from nothing? Societies that they could not enjoy in completed form in their own lifetime. Trees that would still be saplings when they died, so to speak."
"Rather unusual people, I suppose."
"Quite unusual. Specifically, people who are not so dependent on crowds of their fellows as to lack the ability to face emptiness. People who even prefer emptiness, who would like to work on their own and face problems by themselves, rather than hide in the herd and share the burden so that their own load is virtually nothing. Individualists, Mr. Bailey. Individualists."
"I see that."
"And our society is founded on that. Every direction in which the spacer worlds have developed further emphasizes our individuality. We are proudly human on Aurora, rather than being huddled sheep on Earth. Mind you, Mr. Bailey, I use the metaphor not as a way of deriding Earth, It is simply a different society, which I find unadmirable, but which you, I suppose, find comforting and ideal.
What has this to do with the founding of the Institute, Dr. Amadiro?
Even proud and healthy individualism has its drawbacks. The greatest minds, working singly even for centuries, cannot progress rapidly if they refuse to communicate their findings. A knotty puzzle may hold up a scientist for a century, when it may be that a colleague has the solution already and is not even aware of the puzzle that it might solve. The Institute is an attempt, in the narrow field of robotics at least, to introduce a certain community of thought.
Is it possible that the particular knotty puzzle you are attacking is that of the construction of a humaniform robot?
Amadiro's eyes twinkled. Yes, that is obvious, isn't it? It was 26 years ago that Fastolf's new mathematical system, which he calls intersectional analysis, made it possible to design humaniform robots. But he kept the system to himself. Years afterward, when all the difficult technical details were worked out, he and Dr. Sarton applied the theory to the design of Daniil. Then Fastolf alone completed Jander. But all of those details were kept secret also. Most roboticists shrugged and felt that this was natural. They could only try individually to work out the details for themselves. I, on the other hand, was struck by the possibility of an institute in which efforts would be pooled. It wasn't easy to persuade other roboticists of the usefulness of the plan, or to persuade the legislature to fund it against Fastolf's formidable opposition, or to persevere through the years of effort. But here we are.
Bailey said, "Why was Dr. Fastolf opposed?"
"Ordinary self-love, to begin with, and I have no fault to find with that, you understand. All of us have a very natural self-love. It comes with the territory of individualism. The point is that Fastolf considers himself the greatest roboticist in history, and also considers the humaniform robot his own particular achievement. He doesn't want that achievement duplicated by a group of roboticists individually faceless compared to himself. I imagine he viewed it as a conspiracy of inferiors to dilute and deface his own great victory."
"You say that was his motive for opposition to begin with. That means there were other motives. What were they?"
"He also objects to the uses to which we plan to put the humaniform robots."
"What uses are these, Dr. Amadiro?"
Now, let's not be ingenuous. Surely Dr. Fastolf has told you of the globalist plans for settling the galaxy?"
"That he has, and for that matter, Dr. Vasilia has spoken to me of the difficulties of scientific advance among individualists. However, that does not stop me from wanting to hear your views on these matters. Nor should it stop you from wanting to tell me. For instance, do you want me to accept Dr. Fastolf's interpretation of globalist plans as unbiased and impartial? And would you state that for the record? Or would you prefer to describe your plans in your own words?"
"Put that way, Mr. Bailey, you intend to give me no choice."
"None, Dr. Amadiro."
"Very well. We, for the people at the Institute are like-minded in this, look into the future and wish to see humanity opening ever more and ever newer planets to settlement. We do not, however, want the process of self-selection to destroy the older planets or to reduce them to more abundancy, as in the case, pardon me, of Earth. We don't want the new planets to take the best of us and to leave behind the dregs. You see that, don't you?"
"Please go on."
"In any robot-oriented society, as in the case of our own, the easy solution is to send out robots as settlers. The robots will build the society and the world, and we can then all follow later without selection, for the new world will be as comfortable and as adjusted to ourselves as the old worlds were, so that we can go on to new worlds without leaving home, so to speak."
"Won't the robots create robot worlds rather than human worlds?"
"Exactly, if we send out robots that are nothing but robots. We have, however, the opportunity of sending out humaniform robots like Daniil here, who, in creating worlds for themselves, would automatically create worlds for us. Dr. Fastolf, however, objects to this. He finds some virtue in the thought of human beings carving a new world out of a strange and forbidding planet, and does not see that the effect to do so would not only cost enormously in human life, but would also create a world molded by catastrophic events into something not at all like the worlds we know."
"As the spacer worlds today are different from Earth and from each other?"
Amadiro, for a moment, lost his joviality and looked thoughtful. "Actually, Mr. Bailey, you touch an important point. I am discussing Aurora only. The spacer worlds do indeed differ among themselves, and I am not overly fond of most of them. It is clear to me, though I may be prejudiced,
but Aurora, the oldest among them, is also the best and most successful. I don't want a variety of new worlds, of which only a few might be really valuable. I want many Auroras, uncounted millions of Auroras. And for that reason, I want new worlds carved into Auroras before human beings go there. That's why we call ourselves globalists, by the way. We are concerned with this globe of ours, Aurora, and no other.
Do you see no value in variety, Dr. Amadeiro?
If the varieties were equally good, perhaps there would be value. But if some or most are inferior, how would that benefit humanity?
When do you start this work?
When we have the humaniform robots with which to do it. So far, there were Fastolf's two, of which he destroyed one, leaving Daniil the only specimen.
His eyes strayed briefly to Daniil as he spoke. When will you have humaniform robots?
That is difficult to say. We have not yet caught up with Dr. Fastolf.
Even though he is one and you are many, Dr. Amadeiro.
Amadeiro twitched his shoulders slightly. You waste your sarcasm, Mr. Bailey. Fastolf was well ahead of us to begin with, and though the Institute has been in embryo for a long time, we have been fully at work for only 2 years. Besides, it will be necessary for us not only to catch up with Fastolf, but to move ahead of him. Daniil is a good product, but he is only a prototype and is not good enough.
In what way must the humaniform robots be improved beyond Daniil's mark?
They must be even more human, obviously. They must exist in both sexes, and there must be the equivalent of children. We must have a generational spread if a sufficiently human society is to be built up on the planets.
I think I see difficulties, Dr. Amadeiro.
No doubt there are many. Which difficulties do you foresee, Mr. Bailey?
If you produce humaniform robots who are so humaniform they can produce a human society, and if they are produced with a generational spread in both sexes, how will you be able to distinguish them from human beings?
Will that matter?
It might. If such robots are too human, they might melt into Auroran society and become part of human family groups, and might not be suitable for service as pioneers.
Amadeiro laughed. That thought clearly entered your head because of Gladia Delmar's attachment to gender. You see, I know something of your interview with that woman from my conversations with Grimianus and with Dr. Vasilia. I remind you that Gladia is from Solaria, and her notion of what constitutes a husband is not necessarily Auroran in nature.
I was not thinking of her in particular. I was thinking that sex on Aurora is broadly interpreted, and that robots as sex partners are tolerated even now, with robots who are only approximately humaniform. If you really cannot tell a robot from a human being,
there's the question of children. Robots can neither father nor mother children.
But that brings up another point. The robots will be long-lived, since the proper building of the society may take centuries.
They would, in any case, have to be long-lived if they are to resemble Aurorans.
And the children, also long-lived?
Amadeiro did not speak. Bailey said,
These will be artificial robot children and will never grow older. They will not age and mature. Surely this will create an element sufficiently non-human to cast the nature of the society into doubt.
Amadeiro sighed. You are penetrating, Mr. Bailey. It is indeed our thought to devise some scheme whereby robots can produce babies who can in some fashion grow and mature, at least long enough to establish the society we want.
And then, when human beings arrive, the robots can be restored to more robotic schemes of behavior.
Perhaps, if that seems advisable.
And this production of babies, clearly it would be best if the system used were as close to the human as possible, wouldn't it?
Possibly.
Sex, fertilization, birth?
Possibly.
And if these robots form a society so human that they cannot be differentiated from human, then when true human beings arrive, might it not be that the robots would resent the immigrants and try to keep them off? Might the robots not react to Aurorans as you react to Earth people?
Mr. Bailey, the robots would still be bound by the three laws.
The three laws speak of refraining from injuring human beings and of obeying human beings.
Exactly.
And what if the robots are so close to human beings that they regard themselves as the human beings they should protect and obey? They might very rightly place themselves above the immigrants.
My good Mr. Bailey, why are you so concerned with all these things? They are for the far future.
There will be solutions as we progress in time and as we understand by observation what the problems really are.
It may be, Dr. Amadeiro, that Aurorans may not very much approve what you are planning. Once they understand what it is, they may prefer Dr. Fastolf's views.
Indeed, Fastolf thinks that if Aurorans cannot settle new planets directly and without the help of robots, then Earth people should be encouraged to do so.
Bailey said, "It seems to me that that makes good sense."
"Because you are an Earthman, my good Bailey. I assure you that Aurorans would not find it pleasant to have Earth people swarming over the new worlds, building new beehives and forming some sort of galactic empire in their trillions and quadrillions, and reducing the spacer worlds to what? To insignificance at best, and to extinction at worst."
"But the alternative to that is worlds of humaniform robots, building quasi-human societies and allowing no true human beings among themselves. There would gradually develop a robotic galactic empire, reducing the spacer worlds to insignificance at best and to extinction at worst. Surely Aurorans would prefer a human galactic empire to a robotic one."
"What makes you so sure of that, Mr. Bailey?"
"The form your society takes now makes me sure. I was told on my way to Aurora that no distinctions are made between robots and human beings on Aurora, but that is clearly wrong. It may be a wished-for ideal that Aurorans flatter themselves truly exists, but it does not."
"You've been here, what, less than 2 days, and you can already tell?"
"Yes, Dr. Amadeiro. It may be precisely because I'm a stranger that I can see clearly. I am not blinded by custom and ideals. Robots are not permitted to enter personals, and that's one distinction that is clearly made. It permits human beings to find one place where they can be alone. You and I sit at our ease while robots remain standing in their niches, as you see."
Bailey waved his arm toward Daniil,
"which is another distinction. I think that human beings, even Aurorans, will always be eager to make distinctions and to preserve their own humanity."
"Astonishing, Mr. Bailey."
"Not astonishing at all, Dr. Amadeiro. You have lost. Even if you manage to foist your belief that Dr. Fastolf destroyed Xander upon Aurorans generally, even if you reduce Dr. Fastolf to political impotence, even if you get the legislature and the Auroran people to approve your plan of robot settlement, you will only have gained time. As soon as the Aurorans see the implications of your plan, they will turn against you. It might be better, then, if you put an end to your campaign against Dr. Fastolf and meet with him to work out some compromise whereby the settlement of new worlds by Earthmen can be so arranged as to represent no threat to Aurora or to the spacer worlds in general."
"Astonishing, Mr. Bailey," said Amadeiro a second time.
"You have no choice," said Bailey flatly.
But Amadeiro answered in a leisurely and amused tone,
"When I say your remarks are astonishing, I do not refer to the content of your statements, but only to the fact that you make them at all, and that you think they are worth something."
56. Bailey watched Amadeiro forage for one last piece of pastry and put half of it into his mouth, clearly enjoying it.
"Very good," said Amadeiro, "but I am a little too fond of eating. What was I saying? Oh, yes. Mr. Bailey, do you think you have discovered a secret? That I have told you something that our world does not already know? That my plans are dangerous, but that I blab them to every newcomer? I imagine you may think that if I talk to you long enough, I will surely produce some verbal folly that you will be able to make use of. Be assured that I am not likely to. My plans for ever more humaniform robots, for robot families, and for as human a culture as possible are all on record. They are available to the legislature and to anyone who is interested."
Bailey said, "Does the general public know?"
"Probably not. The general public has its own priorities and is more interested in the next meal, the next hyperwave show, the next space soccer contest, than in the next century and the next millennium. Still, the general public will be as glad to accept my plans as are the intellectually minded who already know. Those who object will not be numerous enough to matter."
"Can you be certain of that?"
"Oddly enough, I can be. You don't understand, I'm afraid, the intensity of the feelings that Aurorans, and spacers generally, have toward Earth people. I don't share those feelings, mind you, and I am, for instance, quite at ease with you. I don't have that primitive fear of infection. I don't imagine that you smell bad. I don't attribute to you all sorts of personality traits that I find offensive. I don't think that you and yours are plotting to take our lives or steal our property. But the large majority of Aurorans have all these attitudes. It may not be very close to the surface, and Aurorans may bring themselves to be very polite to individual Earth people who seem harmless.
But put them to the test, and all their hatred and suspicion will emerge. Tell them that Earth people are swarming over new worlds and will preempt the galaxy, and they will howl for Earth's destruction before such a thing can happen.
Even if the alternative was a robot society?
Certainly. You don't understand how we feel about robots, either. We are familiar with them. We are at home with them.
No. They are your servants. You feel superior to them and are at home with them only while that superiority is maintained. If you are threatened by an overturn, by having them become your superiors, you will react with horror.
You say that only because that is how Earth people would react.
No. You keep them out of the personals. It is a symptom.
They have no use for those rooms. They have their own facilities for washing, and they do not excrete. Of course, they are not truly humaniform. If they were, we might not make that distinction.
You would fear them the more.
Truly, said Amadiro. That's foolish. Do you fear Daniil? If I can trust that hyperwave show, and I admit I do not think I can, you developed a considerable affection for Daniil. You feel it now, don't you?
Bailey's silence was eloquent, and Amadiro pursued his advantage.
Right now, he said, you are unmoved by the fact that Giscard is standing, silent and unresponsive, in an alcove. But I can tell by small examples of body language that you are uneasy over the fact that Daniil is doing so, too. You feel he is too human in appearance to be treated as a robot. You don't fear him the more because he looks human.
I am an Earthman. We have robots, said Bailey, but not a robot culture. You cannot judge from my case.
And Gladia, who preferred Jander to human beings.
She is a Solarian. You cannot judge from her case, either.
What case can you judge from, then? You are only guessing. To me, it seems obvious that if a robot is human enough, he would be accepted as human. Do you demand proof that I am not a robot? The fact that I seem human is enough. In the end, we will not worry whether a new world is settled by Aurorans who are human in fact or in appearance, if no one can tell the difference. But human or robot, the settlers will be Aurorans, either way, not Earth people.
Bailey's assurance faltered. He said unconvincingly, what if you never learn how to construct a humaniform robot?
Why would you expect we would not? Notice that I say we. There are many of us involved here.
It may be that any number of mediocrities do not add up to one genius.
Amadiro said shortly, we are not mediocrities. Fastolf may yet find it profitable to come in with us.
I don't think so.
I do. He will not enjoy being without power in the legislature, and when our plans for settling the galaxy move ahead and he sees that his opposition does not stop us, he will join us. It will be only human of him to do so.
I don't think he will win out, said Bailey.
Because you think that somehow this investigation of yours will exonerate Fastolf and implicate me, perhaps, or someone else.
Perhaps, said Bailey, desperately.
Amadiro shook his head. My friend, if I thought that anything you could do would spoil my plans, would I be sitting still and waiting for destruction?
You are not. You are doing everything you can to have this investigation aborted. Why would you do that if you were confident that nothing I could do would get in your way?
Well, said Amadiro, you can get in my way by demoralizing some of the members of the Institute. You can't be dangerous, but you can be annoying, and I don't want that either. So if I can, I'll put an end to the annoyance, but I'll do that in reasonable fashion, in gentle fashion even. If you were actually dangerous...
What could you do, Dr. Amadiro, in that case?
I could have you seized and imprisoned until you were evicted. I don't think Aurorans generally would worry over much about what I might do to an Earthman.
Bailey said, you are trying to browbeat me, and that won't work. You know very well you could not lay a hand on me with my robots present.
Amadiro said, does it occur to you that I have 100 robots within call? What would yours do against them?
All 100 could not harm me. They cannot distinguish between Earthmen and Aurorans. I am human within the meaning of the 3 laws.
They could hold you quite immobilized without harming you, while your robots were destroyed.
Not so, said Bailey. Giscard can hear you, and if you make a move to summon your robots, Giscard will have you immobilized. He moves very quickly, and once that happens, your robots will be helpless, even if you manage to call them. They will understand that any move against me will result in harm to you.
You mean that Giscard will hurt me?
To protect me from harm? Certainly. He will kill you if absolutely necessary.
Surely you don't mean that.
I do, said Bailey. Daniil and Giscard have orders to protect me.
The first law in this respect has been strengthened with all the skill Dr. Fastolf can bring to the job. And with respect to me, specifically, I haven't been told this in so many words, but I'm quite sure it's true. If my robots must choose between harm to you and harm to me, Earthman though I am, it will be easy for them to choose harm to you. I imagine you are well aware that Dr. Fastolf is not very eager to ensure your well-being. Amadeiro chuckled and a grin wreathed his face. I'm sure you're right in every respect, Mr. Bailey, but it is good to have you say so. You know, my good sir, that I am recording this conversation also. I told you so at the start, and I'm glad of it. It is possible that Dr. Fastolf will erase the last part of this conversation, but I assure you I won't. It is clear from what you have said that he is quite prepared to devise a robotic way of doing harm to me, even kill me if he can manage that, whereas it cannot be said from anything in this conversation, or any other, that I plan any physical harm to him whatever, or even to you. Which of us is the villain, Mr. Bailey? I think you have established that, and I think, then, that this is a good place at which to end the interview. He rose, still smiling, and Bailey, swallowing hard, stood up as well, almost automatically. Amadeiro said, I still have one thing to say, however. It has nothing to do with our little contretemps here on Aurora. Fastolf's and mine. Rather, with your own problem, Mr. Bailey. My problem? Perhaps I should say Earth's problem. I imagine that you feel very anxious to save poor Fastolf from his own folly because you think that will give your planet a chance for expansion. Don't think so, Mr. Bailey. You are quite wrong, rather arsy-varsy, to use a vulgar expression I've come across in some of your planet's historical novels. I'm not familiar with that phrase, said Bailey stiffly. I mean you have the situation reversed. You see, when my view wins out in the legislature, and note that I say when and not if, Earth will be forced to remain in her own planetary system, I admit, but that will actually be to her benefit. Aurora will have the prospect of expansion and of establishing an endless empire. If we then know that Earth will merely be Earth and never anything more, of what concern will she be to us? With the galaxy at our disposal, we will not begrudge Earth people their one world. We would even be disposed to make Earth as comfortable a world for her people as would be practical. On the other hand, Mr. Bailey, if Aurorans do what Fastolf asks and allow Earth to send out settling parties, then it won't be long before it will occur to an increasing number of us that Earth will take over the galaxy, and that we will be encircled and hemmed in, that we will be doomed to decay and death. After that, there will be nothing I can do. My own quite kindly feeling toward Earthmen will not be able to withstand the general kindling of Auroran suspicion and prejudice, and it will then be very bad for Earth. So, if, Mr. Bailey, you are truly concerned for your own people, you should be very anxious indeed for Fastolf not to succeed in foisting upon this planet his very misguided plan. You should be a strong ally of mine. Think about it. I tell you this, I assure you, out of a sincere friendship and liking for you and for your planet. Amadeiro was smiling as broadly as ever, but it was all Wolf now. 57. Bailey and his robots followed Amadeiro out the room and along the corridor. Amadeiro stopped at one inconspicuous door and said, Would you care to use the facilities before leaving? For a moment, Bailey frowned in confusion, for he did not understand. Then he remembered the antiquated phrase Amadeiro had used, thanks to his own reading of historical novels. He said, There was an ancient general whose name I have forgotten, who, mindful of the exigencies of sudden absorption in military affairs, once said, Never turn down a chance to piss. Amadeiro smiled broadly and said, Excellent advice. Quite as good as my advice to think seriously about what I have said. But I notice that you hesitate, even so. Surely you don't think I am laying a trap for you. Believe me, I am not a barbarian. You are my guest in this building, and for that reason alone you are perfectly safe. Bailey said cautiously, If I hesitate, it is because I am considering the propriety of using your, facilities, considering that I am not an Auroran. Nonsense, my dear Bailey. What is your alternative? Needs must. Please make use of it. Let that be a symbol that I myself am not subject to the general Auroran prejudices, and wish you and Earth well. Could you go a step further? In what way, Mr. Bailey? Could you show me that you are also superior to this planet's prejudice against robots? There is no prejudice against robots, said Amadeiro quickly. Bailey nodded his head solemnly in apparent acceptance of the remark, and completed his sentence.
by allowing them to enter the personal with me. I have grown to feel uncomfortable without them.
For one moment, Amadeiro seemed shaken. He recovered almost at once and said, with what was almost a scowl, "By all means, Mr. Bailey."
"Yet whoever is now inside might object strenuously. I would not want to create scandal."
"No one is in there. It is a one-person personal, and if someone were making use of it, the in-use signal would indicate that."
"Thank you, Dr. Amadeiro," said Bailey. He opened the door and said, "Giscard, please enter."
Giscard clearly hesitated, but said nothing in objection, and entered. At a gesture from Bailey, Daniil followed, but as he passed through the door, he took Bailey's elbow and pulled him in as well. Bailey said, as the door closed behind him,
"I'll be out again soon. Thank you for allowing this."
He entered the room with as much unconcern as he could manage, and yet he felt a tightness in the pit of his abdomen. Might it contain some unpleasant surprise?
58.
Bailey found the personal empty, however. There was not even much to search. It was smaller than the one in Fastolf's establishment. Eventually he noticed Daniil and Giscard standing silently, side by side, backs against the door, as though endeavoring to have entered the room by the least amount possible. Bailey tried to speak normally, but what came out was a dim croak. He cleared his throat with unnecessary noise and said,
"You can come farther into the room, and you needn't remain silent, Daniil."
Daniil had been on Earth. He knew the earthly taboo against speech in the personal. Daniil displayed that knowledge at once. He put his forefinger to his lips.
Bailey said, I know, but forget it. If Amadeiro can forget the Auroran taboo about robots in personals, I can forget the earthly taboo about speech there."
"Will it not make you uncomfortable, Partner Elijah?" asked Daniil in a low voice.
"Not a bit," said Bailey, in an ordinary one.
Actually, speech felt different with Daniil, a robot. The sound of speech in a room such as this, when actually no human being was present, was not as horrifying as it might be. In fact, it was not horrifying at all when only robots were present, however human a form one of them might be. Bailey could not say so, of course. Though Daniil had no feelings a human being could hurt, Bailey had feelings on his behalf. And then Bailey thought of something else and felt quite intensely the sensation of being a thoroughgoing fool.
"Or," he said to Daniil, in a voice that was suddenly very low indeed, "are you suggesting silence because this room is bugged?"
The last word came out merely as a shaping of the mouth. "If you mean, Partner Elijah, that people outside this room can detect what is spoken inside this room through some sort of eavesdropping device, that is quite impossible."
"Why impossible?"
The toilet device flushed itself with quick and silent efficiency, and Bailey advanced toward the washbasin. Daniil said, "On Earth, the dense packing of the cities makes privacy impossible. Overhearing is taken for granted, and to use a device to make overhearing more efficient might seem natural. If an Earthman wishes not to be overheard, he simply doesn't speak, which may be why silence is so mandatory in places where there is a pretense of privacy, as in the very rooms you call personals. On Aurora, on the other hand, as on all the spacer worlds, privacy is a true fact of life and is greatly valued. You remember Solaria and the diseased extremes to which it was carried there. But even on Aurora, which is no Solaria, every human being is insulated from every other human being by the kind of space extension unthinkable on Earth, and by a wall of robots in addition. To break down that privacy would be an unthinkable act."
Bailey said, "Do you mean it would be a crime to bug this room?"
"Much worse, Partner Elijah. It would not be the act of a civilized Auroran gentleman."
Bailey looked about.
Daniil, mistaking the gesture, plucked a towel out of the dispenser, which might not have been instantly apparent to the other's unaccustomed eyes, and offered it to Bailey. Bailey accepted the towel, but that was not the object of his questing glance. It was a bug for which his eyes searched, for he found it difficult to believe that someone would forego an easy advantage on the ground that it would not be civilized behavior. It was, however, useless, and Bailey rather despondently knew it would be. He would not be able to detect an Auroran bug, even if one were there. He wouldn't know what to look for in a strange culture. Whereupon he followed the course of another strand of suspicion in his mind.
"Tell me, Daniil, since you know Aurorans better than I do, why do you suppose Amadeiro is taking all this trouble with me? He talks to me at his leisure. He sees me out. He offers me the use of this room, something Vasilia would not have done. He seems to have all the time in the world to spend on me. Politeness?"
Many Aurorans pride themselves on their politeness. It may be that Amadiro does. He has several times stressed that he is not a barbarian.
Another question. Why do you think he was willing to have me bring you and Giscard into this room?
It seemed to me that this was to remove your suspicions that the offer of this room might conceal a trap.
Why should he bother? Because he was concerned over the possibility of my experiencing unnecessary anxiety.
Another gesture of a civilized Auroran gentleman, I should imagine.
Bailey shook his head.
Well, if this room is bugged and Amadiro can hear me, let him hear me. I don't consider him a civilized Auroran gentleman. He made it quite clear that if I did not abandon my investigation, he would see to it that Earth, as a whole, would suffer. Is that the act of a civilized gentleman, or of an incredibly brutal blackmailer?
Daniil said, An Auroran gentleman may find it necessary to utter threats, but if so, he would do it in a gentlemanly manner.
As Amadiro did. It is then the manner, and not the content, of speech that marks the gentleman. But then, Daniil, you are a robot, and therefore cannot really criticize a human being, can you?
Daniil said, It would be difficult for me to do so. But may I ask a question, Partner Elijah? Why did you ask permission to bring friend Giscard and me into this room? It had seemed to me that you were reluctant earlier to believe you were in danger. Have you now decided that you are not safe except in our presence?
No, not at all, Daniil. I am now quite convinced that I am not in danger and have not been.
Yet there was a distinctly suspicious cast about your actions when you entered this room, Partner Elijah. You searched it.
Bailey said, Of course, I said I am not in danger, but I do not say there is no danger.
I do not think I see the distinction, Partner Elijah, said Daniil.
We will discuss it later, Daniil. I am still not certain as to whether this room is bugged or not.
Bailey was by now quite done. He said,
Well, Daniil, I've been leisurely about this. I haven't rushed at all. Now I'm ready to go out again, and I wonder if Amadiro is still waiting for us after all this time, or whether he has delegated an underling to do the rest of the job of showing us out. After all, Amadiro is a busy man and cannot spend all day with me. What do you think, Daniil?
It would be more logical if Dr. Amadiro had delegated the task.
And you, Giscard, what do you think?
I agree with friend Daniil, though it is my experience that human beings do not always make what would seem the logical response.
Bailey said,
For my part, I suspect Amadiro is waiting for us quite patiently. If something has driven him to waste this much time on us, I rather think that the driving force, whatever it might be, has not yet weakened.
I do not know what might be the driving force you speak of, Partner Elijah, said Daniil.
Nor I, Daniil, said Bailey, which bothers me a great deal. But let us open the door now and see.
59. Amadiro was waiting outside the door for them, precisely where Bailey had left him. He smiled at them, showing no sign of impatience. Bailey could not resist shooting a quiet, I told you so, glance at Daniil, who responded with bland impassivity. Amadiro said, I rather regretted, Mr. Bailey, that you had not left Giscard outside when you entered the personal. I might have known him in times past when Fastolf and I were on better terms, but somehow never did. Fastolf was my teacher once, you know.
Was he? Said Bailey. I didn't know that, as a matter of fact.
No reason you should, unless you had been told, and in the short time you've been on the planet, you can scarcely have had time to learn much in the way of this sort of trivia, I suppose. Come now, it has occurred to me that you can scarcely think me hospitable if I do not take advantage of your being at the Institute to show you around.
Really, said Bailey, stiffening a bit,
I insist, said Amadiro, with something of a note of the imperious entering his voice. You arrived on Aurora yesterday morning, and I doubt that you will be staying on the planet much longer. This may be the only chance you will ever have of getting a glimpse of a modern laboratory doing research work on robotics.
He linked arms with Bailey and continued to speak in familiar terms. Prattled was the term that occurred to the astonished Bailey.
You've washed, said Amadiro. You've taken care of your needs. There may be other roboticists here whom you will wish to question, and I would welcome that, since I am determined to show I have put no barriers in your way during the short time in which you will yet be permitted to conduct your investigation. In fact, there is no reason you can't have dinner with us.
Giscard said, If I may interrupt, sir.
You may not, said Amadiro, with unmistakable firmness, and the robot fell silent.
Amadiro said, My dear Mr. Bailey, I understand these robots. Who should know them better?
Except for the unfortunate Fastolf, of course. Giscard, I am sure, was going to remind you of some appointment, some promise, some business. And there is no point in any of that.
Since the investigation is about over, I promise you none of what he was going to remind you of will have any significance. Let us forget all such nonsense and for a brief time be friends. You must understand, my good Mr. Bailey, he went on, that I'm quite an aficionado of Earth and its culture. It is not the most popular of subjects on Aurora, but I find it fascinating. I am particularly interested in Earth's past history, the days when it had 100 languages and interstellar standard had not yet been developed. May I compliment you, by the way, on your own handling of interstellar? This way, he said, turning a corner. We'll be coming to the pathway simulation room, which has its own weird beauty, and we may have a mock-up in operation. Quite symphonic, actually. But I was talking about your handling of interstellar. It is one of the many Auroran superstitions concerning Earth that Earth people speak in all but incomprehensible version of interstellar. When the show about you was produced, there were many who said that the actors could not be Earth people because they could be understood. Yet I can understand you. He smiled as he said that. I've tried reading Shakespeare, he continued with a confidential air, but I can't read him in the original, of course, and the translation is curiously flat. I can't help but believe that the fault lies with the translation and not with Shakespeare. I do better with Dickens and Tolstoy, perhaps because that is prose, although the names of the characters are in both cases virtually unpronounceable to me. What I'm trying to say, Mr. Bailey, is that I'm a friend of Earth. I really am. I want what is best for it. Do you understand? He looked at Bailey, and again the wolf showed in his twinkling eyes. Bailey raised his voice, forcing it between the softly running sentences of the other. I'm afraid I cannot oblige you, Dr. Amadeiro. I must be about my business, and I have no further questions to ask of either you or anyone else here. If you... Bailey paused. There was a faint and curious rumble of sound in the air. He looked up, startled. What is that? What is what? Asked Amadeiro. I sense nothing. He looked at the robots, who had been following the two human beings in grave silence. Nothing, he said forcefully. Nothing. Bailey recognized that as the equivalent of an order. Neither robot could now claim to have heard the rumble, in direct contradiction to a human being, unless Bailey himself applied a counter-pressure, and he was sure he could not manage to do it skillfully enough in the face of Amadeiro's professionalism. Nevertheless, it didn't matter. He had heard something, and he was not a robot. He would not be talked out of it. He said, By your own statement, Dr. Amadeiro, I have little time left me. That is all the more reason that I must... The rumble again, louder. Bailey said with a sharp cutting edge to his voice, That, I suppose, is precisely what you didn't hear before and what you don't hear now. Let me go, sir, or I will ask my robots for help. Amadeiro loosened his grip on Bailey's upper arm at once. My friend, you had but to express the wish. Come, I will take you to the nearest exit, and if ever you are on Aurora again, which seems unlikely in the extreme, please return, and you may have the tour I promised you. They were walking faster. They moved down the spiral ramp out along a corridor to the commodious and now empty anteroom and the door by which they had entered. The windows in the anteroom showed utterly dark. Could it be night already? It wasn't. Amadeiro muttered to himself, Rotten weather. They've opacified the windows. He turned to Bailey. I imagine it's raining. They predicted it, and the forecasts can usually be relied on, always when they're unpleasant. The door opened, and Bailey jumped backward with a gasp. A cold wind gusted inward, and against the sky, not black but a dull dark gray, the tops of trees were whipping back and forth. There was water pouring from the sky, descending in streams. And as Bailey watched, appalled, a streak of light flashed across the sky with blinding brilliance, and then the rumble came again, this time with a cracking report, as though the light streak had split the sky, and the rumble was the noise it had made. Bailey turned and fled back the way he had come, whimpering. Chapter 15. Again, Daniil and Giscard. 60. Bailey felt Daniil's strong grip on his arms just beneath his shoulders. He halted and forced himself to stop making that infantile sound. He could feel himself trembling. Daniil said with infinite respect, Partner Elijah, it is a thunderstorm. Expected. Predicted. Normal. I know that, whispered Bailey. He did know it. Thunderstorms had been described innumerable times in the books he had read, whether fiction or nonfiction. He had seen them in holographs and on hyperwave shows, sound, sight, and all. The real thing, however, the actual sound and sight, had never penetrated into the bowels of the city, and he had never in his life actually experienced such a thing. With all he knew intellectually about thunderstorms, he could not face viscerally the actuality.
Despite the descriptions, the collections of words, the sight in small pictures and on small screens, the sounds captured in recordings, despite all that, he had no idea the flashes were so bright and streaked so across the sky, that the sound was so vibratorily bass in sound when it rattled across a hollow world, that both were so sudden, and that rain could be so like an inverted bowl of water, endlessly pouring. He muttered in despair, "I can't go out in that." "You won't have to," said Daniil urgently. "Giscard will get the airfoil. It will be brought right to the door for you. Not a drop of rain will fall on you."
"Why not wait until it's over?"
"Surely that would not be advisable, Partner Elijah. Some rain, at least, will continue past midnight, and if the chairman arrives tomorrow morning, as Dr. Amadiro implied he might, it might be wise to spend the evening in consultation with Dr. Fastolf." Bailey forced himself to turn around, face in the direction from which he wanted to flee, and look into Daniil's eyes. They seemed deeply concerned, but Bailey thought dismally that that was merely the result of his own interpretation of the appearance of those eyes. The robot had no feelings, only positronic surges that mimicked those feelings. And perhaps human beings had no feelings, only neuronic surges that were interpreted as feelings. He was somehow aware that Amadiro was gone. He said, "Amadiro delayed me deliberately, by ushering me into the personal, by his senseless talk, by his preventing you or Giscard from interrupting and warning me about the storm. He would even have tried to persuade me to tour the building or dine with him. He desisted only at the sound of the storm. That was what he was waiting for."
"It would seem so. If the storm now keeps you here, that may be what he was waiting for."
Bailey drew a deep breath. "You are right. I must leave, somehow." Reluctantly, he took a step toward the door, which was still open, still filled with a dark gray vista of whipping rain. Another step, and still another, leaning heavily on Daniil. Giscard was waiting quietly at the door. Bailey paused and closed his eyes for a moment. Then he said in a low voice, to himself rather than to Daniil, "I must do it," and moved forward again.
61.
"Are you well, sir?" asked Giscard. It was a foolish question, dictated by the programming of the robot, thought Bailey, though at that it was no worse than the questions asked by human beings, sometimes with wild inappropriateness, out of the programming of etiquette. "Yes," said Bailey, in a voice he tried and failed to raise above a husky whisper. It was a useless answer to the foolish question, for Giscard, robot though he was, could surely see that Bailey was unwell, and that Bailey's answer was a palpable lie. The answer was, however, given and accepted, and that freed Giscard for the next step. He said, "I will now leave to get the airfoil and bring it to the door."
"Will it work in all this water, Giscard?"
"Yes, sir. This is not an uncommon rain."
He left, moving steadily into the downpour. The lightning was flickering almost continuously, and the thunder was a muted growl that rose to a louder crescendo every few minutes. For the first time in his life, Bailey found himself envying a robot. Imagine being able to walk through that, to be indifferent to water, to sight, to sound, to be able to ignore surroundings and to have a pseudo-life that was absolutely courageous, to know no fear of pain or of death, because there was no pain or death, and yet to be incapable of originality of thought, to be incapable of unpredictable leaps of intuition. Were such gifts worth what humanity paid for them? At the moment, Bailey could not say. He knew that once he no longer felt terror, he would know that no price was too high to pay for being human. But now that he experienced nothing but the pounding of his heart and the collapse of his will, he could not help but wonder of what use it might be to be a human being if one could not overcome these deep-seated terrors, this intense agoraphobia. Yet he had been in the open for much of 2 days and had managed to be almost comfortable. But the fear had not been conquered. He knew that now. He had suppressed it by thinking intensely of other things, but the storm overrode all intensity of thought. He could not allow this. If all else failed, thought, pride, will, then he would have to fall back on shame. He could not collapse under the impersonal superior gaze of the robots. Shame would have to be stronger than fear. He felt Daniil's steady arm about his waist, and shame prevented him from doing what at the moment he most wanted to do, to turn and hide his face against the robotic chest. He might have been unable to resist if Daniil had been human. He had lost contact with reality, for he was becoming aware of Daniil's voice as though it were reaching him from a long distance. It sounded as though Daniil was feeling something akin to panic. "Partner Elijah, do you hear me?"
Giscard's voice, from an equal distance, said, "We must carry him."
"No," mumbled Bailey. "Let me walk."
Perhaps they did not hear him. Perhaps he did not really speak, but merely thought he did. He felt himself lifted from the ground. His left arm dangled helplessly, and he strove to lift it, to push it against someone's shoulder, to lift himself upright again from the waist, to grope for the floor with his feet and stand upright. But his left arm continued to dangle helplessly, and his striving went for nothing. He was somehow aware that he was moving through the air, and he felt a wash of spray against his face, not actually water, but the sifting of damp air. Then there was the pressure of a hard surface against his left side, a more resilient one against his right side. He was in the airfoil, wedged in once more between Giscard and Daniil. What he was most conscious of was that Giscard was very wet. He felt a jet of warm air cascading over him. Between the near darkness outside and the film of trickling water upon the glass, they might as well have been opacified, or so Bailey thought, till opacification actually took place and total darkness descended. The soft noise of the jet, as the airfoil rose above the grass and swayed, muted the thunder and seemed to draw its teeth. Giscard said, "I regret the discomfort of my wet surface, sir. I will dry quickly. We will wait here a short while, till you recover." Bailey was breathing more easily. He felt wonderfully and comfortably enclosed. He thought, "Give me back my city. Wipe out all the universe and let the spacers colonize it. Earth is all we need." And even as he thought it, he knew it was his madness that believed it, not he. He felt the need to keep his mind busy. He said weakly, "Daniil." "Yes, partner Elijah?"
"About the chairman. Is it your opinion that Amadiro was judging the situation correctly in supposing that the chairman would put an end to the investigation? Or was he perhaps allowing his wishes to do his thinking for him?"
"It may be, partner Elijah, that the chairman will indeed interview Dr. Fastolf and Amadiro on the matter. It would be a standard procedure for settling a dispute of this nature. There are ample precedents."
"But why?" asked Bailey weakly. "If Amadiro was so persuasive, why should not the chairman simply order the investigation stopped?"
"The chairman," said Daniil, "is in a difficult political situation. He agreed originally to allow you to be brought to Aurora at Dr. Fastolf's urging, and he cannot so sharply reverse himself so soon without making himself look weak and irresolute, and without angering Dr. Fastolf, who is still a very influential figure in the legislature."
"Then why did he not simply turn down Amadiro's request?"
"Dr. Amadiro was also influential, partner Elijah, and likely to grow even more so. The chairman must temporize by hearing both sides and by giving at least the appearance of deliberation before coming to a decision."
"Based on what?"
"On the merits of the case, we must presume."
"Then by tomorrow morning I must come up with something that will persuade the chairman to side with Fastolf rather than against him. If I do that, will that mean victory?"
Daniil said, "The chairman is not all-powerful, but his influence is great. If he comes out strongly on Dr. Fastolf's side, then under the present political conditions, Dr. Fastolf will probably win the backing of the legislature." Bailey found himself beginning to think clearly again.
"That would seem explanation enough for Amadiro's attempt to delay us. He might have reasoned that I had nothing yet to offer the chairman, and he needed only to delay to keep me from getting anything in the time that remained to me."
"So it would seem, partner Elijah."
"And he let me go only when he thought he could rely on the storm continuing to keep me."
"Perhaps so, partner Elijah."
"In that case, we cannot allow the storm to stop us."
Giscard said calmly, "Where do you wish to be taken, sir?"
"Back to the establishment of Dr. Fastolf."
Daniil said, "May we have one moment's more pause, partner Elijah? Do you plan to tell Dr. Fastolf that you cannot continue the investigation?"
Bailey said sharply, "Why do you say that?"
It was a measure of his recovery that his voice was loud and angry. Daniil said, "It is merely that I fear you might have forgotten for a moment that Dr. Amadiro urged you to do so for the sake of Earth's welfare."
"I have not forgotten," said Bailey grimly. "And I am surprised, Daniil, that you should think that that would influence me. Fastolf must be exonerated, and Earth must send its settlers outward into the galaxy. If there is danger in that from the globalists, that danger must be chanced."
"But in that case, partner Elijah, why go back to Dr. Fastolf? It doesn't seem to me that we have anything of moment to report to him. Is there no direction in which we can further continue our investigation before reporting to Dr. Fastolf?" Bailey sat up in his seat and placed his hand on Giscard, who was now entirely dry. He said, in quite a normal voice,
"I am satisfied with the progress I have already made, Daniil.
Let's get moving, Giscard. Proceed to Fastolf's establishment.
And then, tightening his fists and stiffening his body, Bailey added,
What's more, Giscard, clear the windows. I want to look out into the face of the storm.
62. Bailey held his breath in preparation for transparency. The small box of the airfoil would no longer be entirely enclosed. It would no longer have unbroken walls. As the windows clarified, there was a flash of light that came and went too quickly to do anything but darken the world by contrast. Bailey could not prevent his cringe as he tried to steel himself for the thunder, which, after a moment or two, rolled and grumbled. The Neil said pacifyingly, The storm will get no worse, and soon enough it will recede.
I don't care whether it recedes or not, said Bailey through trembling lips. Come on, let's go.
He was trying, for his own sake, to maintain the illusion of a human being in charge of robots. The airfoil rose slightly in the air, and at once underwent a sideways movement that tilted it so that Bailey felt himself pushing hard against Giscard. Bailey cried out, gasped out, rather,
Straighten the vehicle, Giscard.
Daniil placed his arm around Bailey's shoulder and pulled him gently back. His other arm was braced about a hand grip attached to the frame of the airfoil.
That cannot be done, partner Elijah, Daniil said. There is a fairly strong wind.
Bailey felt his hair bristle.
You mean we're going to be blown away?
No, of course not, said Daniil. If the car were anti-grav, a form of technology that does not, of course, exist, and if its mass and inertia were eliminated, then it would be blown like a feather high into the air. However, we retain our full mass even when our jets lift us and poise us in the air, so our inertia resists the wind. Nevertheless, the wind makes us sway, even though the car remains completely under Giscard's control.
It doesn't feel like it.
Bailey was conscious of a thin whine, which he imagined to be the wind curling around the body of the airfoil as it cut its way through the protesting atmosphere. Then the airfoil lurched, and Bailey, who could not for his life have helped it, seized Daniil in a desperate grip around the neck. Daniil waited a moment. When Bailey had caught his breath and his grip grew less rigid, Daniil released himself easily from the other's embrace, while somewhat tightening the pressure of his own arm around Bailey. He said, In order to maintain course, partner Elijah, Giscard must counter the wind by an asymmetric ordering of the airfoil's jets. They are sent to one side so as to cause the airfoil to lean into the wind, and these jets have to be adjusted in force and direction as the wind itself changes force and direction. There are none better at this than Giscard, but even so, there are occasional jiggles and lurches. You must excuse Giscard, then, if he does not participate in our conversation. His attention is fully on the airfoil.
Is it safe?
Bailey felt his stomach contract at the thought of playing with the wind in this fashion. He was devoutly glad he had not eaten for some hours. He could not, dared not, be sick in the close confines of the airfoil. The very thought unsettled him further, and he tried to concentrate on something else. He thought of running the strips back on Earth, of racing from one moving strip to its neighboring faster strip, and then to its neighboring still faster strip, and then back down into the slower regions, leaning expertly into the wind either way, in one direction as one fastered, an odd word used by no one but strip racers, and in the other direction as one slowered. In his younger days, Daniil could do it without pause and without error. Daniil had adjusted to the need without trouble, and the one time they had run the strips together, Daniil had done it perfectly. Well, this was just the same. The airfoil was running strips. Absolutely, it was the same. Not quite the same, to be sure. In the city, the speed of the strips was a fixed quantity. What wind there was blew in absolutely predictable fashion, since it was only the result of the movement of the strips. Here in the storm, however, the wind had a mind of its own, or rather it depended on so many variables. Bailey was deliberately striving for rationality, that it seemed to have a mind of its own. And Giscard had to allow for that. That was all. Otherwise, it was just running the strips with an added complication. The strips were moving at variable and sharply changing speeds. Bailey muttered,
What if we blow into a tree?
Very unlikely, partner Elijah. Giscard is far too skillful for that, and we are only very slightly above the ground, so that the jets are particularly powerful.
Then we'll hit a rock. It will cave us in underneath.
We will not hit a rock, partner Elijah.
Why not? How on earth can Giscard see where he's going, anyway?
Bailey stared at the darkness ahead. It is just about sunset, said Daniil, and some light is making its way through the clouds. It is enough for us to see by with the help of our headlights, and as it grows darker, Giscard will brighten the headlights.
What headlights?
asked Bailey rebelliously.
You do not see them very well because they have a strong infrared component to which Giscard's eyes are sensitive, but yours are not. What's more, the infrared is more penetrating than shorter wave light is, and for that reason is more effective in rain, mist, and fog.
Bailey managed to feel some curiosity, even amid his uneasiness.
And your eyes, Daniil?
My eyes, Partner Elijah, are designed to be as similar to those of human beings as possible. That is regrettable, perhaps, at this moment.
The airfoil trembled, and Bailey found himself holding his breath again. He said in a whisper, Spacer eyes are still adapted to Earth's sun, even if robot eyes aren't. A good thing, too, if it helps remind them they're descended from Earth people.
His voice faded out. It was getting darker. He could see nothing at all now, and the intermittent flashes lighted nothing, either. They were merely blinding. He closed his eyes, and that didn't help. He was the more conscious of the angry, threatening thunder. Should they not stop? Should they not wait for the worst of the storm to pass?
Giscard suddenly said, The vehicle is not reacting properly.
Bailey felt the ride become ragged, as though the machine was on wheels and was rolling over ridges.
Daniil said, Can it be storm damage, friend Giscard?
It does not have the feel of that, friend Daniil, nor does it seem likely that this machine would suffer from this kind of damage in this or any other storm.
Bailey absorbed the exchange with difficulty.
Damage? He muttered. What kind of damage?
Giscard said, I should judge the compressor to be leaking, sir, but slowly. It's not the result of an ordinary puncture.
How did it happen, then?
Bailey asked.
Deliberate damage, perhaps, while it was outside the administration building. I have known now for some little time that we are being followed and carefully not being overtaken.
Why, Giscard?
A possibility, sir, that they are waiting for us to break down completely. The airfoil's motion was becoming more ragged.
Can you make it to Dr. Fastoff's?
It would not seem so, sir.
Bailey tried to fling his reeling mind into action.
In that case, I've completely misjudged Amadeiro's reason for delaying us. He was keeping us there to have one or more of his robots damage the airfoil in such a way as to bring us down in the midst of desolation and lightning.
But why should he do that? Said Daniil, sounding shocked.
To get you? In a way, he already had you.
He doesn't want me. No one wants me, said Bailey with a somewhat feeble anger. The danger is to you, Daniil.
To me, Partner Elijah?
Yes, you, Daniil. Giscard, choose a safe place to come down, and as soon as you do, Daniil must get out of the car and be off to a place of safety.
Daniil said, That is impossible, Partner Elijah. I could not leave you when you are feeling ill, and most especially if there are those who pursue us and might do you harm.
Bailey said, Daniil, they're pursuing you. You must leave. As for me, I will stay in the airfoil. I am in no danger.
How can I believe that?
Please, please, how can I explain the whole thing with everything spinning?
Daniil, Bailey's voice grew desperately calm.
You are the most important individual here, far more important than Giscard and I put together. It's not just that I care for you and want no harm to come to you. All of humanity depends on you. Don't worry about me. I'm one man. Worry about billions.
Daniil, please.
63. Bailey could feel himself rocking back and forth. Or was it the airfoil? Was it breaking up altogether? Or was Giscard losing control? Or was he taking evasive action? Bailey didn't care. He didn't care. Let the airfoil crash. Let it smash to bits. He would welcome oblivion. Anything to get rid of this terrible fright, this total inability to come to terms with the universe. Except that he had to make sure that Daniil got away, safely away. But how? Everything was unreal, and he was not going to be able to explain anything to these robots. The situation was so clear to him, but how was he to transfer this understanding to these robots, to these non-men, who understood nothing but their three laws, and who had let all of Earth and, in the long run, all of humanity go to hell because they could only be concerned with the one man under their noses? Why had robots ever been invented? And then, oddly enough, Giscard, the lesser of the two, came to his aid. He said in his contentless voice, Friend Daniil, I cannot keep this airfoil in motion much longer. Perhaps it will be more suitable to do as Mr. Bailey suggests. He has given you a very strong order.
Can I leave him when he is unwell, friend Giscard? Said Daniil, perplexed.
You cannot take him out into the storm with you, friend Daniil. Moreover, he seems so anxious for you to leave that it may do him harm for you to stay.
Bailey felt himself reviving.
Yes, yes, he managed to croak out. As Giscard says, Giscard, you go with him, hide him, make sure he doesn't return, then come back for me.
Daniil said forcefully, "That cannot be, Partner Elijah. We cannot leave you alone, untended, unguarded."
"No danger. I am in no danger. Do as I say."
Giscard said, "Those following are probably robots. Human beings would hesitate to come out in the storm, and robots would not harm Mr. Bailey."
Daniil said, "They might take him away."
"Not into the storm, friend Daniil, since that would work obvious harm to him. I will bring the airfoil to a halt now, friend Daniil. You must be ready to do as Mr. Bailey orders. I, too."
"Good," whispered Bailey. "Good."
He was grateful for the simpler brain that could more easily be impressed and that lacked the ability to get lost and uncertain in ever-expanding refinements. Vaguely, he thought of Daniil, trapped between his perception of Bailey's ill-being and the urgency of the order, and of his brain snapping under the conflict. Bailey thought, "No, no, Daniil, just do as I say and don't question it." He lacked the strength, almost the will, to articulate it, and he let the order remain a thought. The airfoil came down with a bump and a short, harsh, scraping noise. The doors flew open, one on either side, and then closed with a soft, sighing noise. At once, the robots were gone. Having come to their decision, there was no hesitation, and they moved with a speed that human beings could not duplicate. Bailey took a deep breath and shuddered. The airfoil was rock steady now. It was part of the ground. He was suddenly aware of how much of his misery had been the result of the swaying and bucking of the vehicle, the feeling of insubstantiality, of not being connected to the universe, but of being at the mercy of inanimate, uncaring forces. Now, however, it was still, and he opened his eyes. He had not been aware that they had been closed. There was still lightning on the horizon, and the thunder was a subdued mutter, while the wind, meeting a more resistant and less yielding object now than it had hitherto, keened a higher note than before. It was dark. Bailey's eyes were no more than human, and he saw no light of any kind other than the occasional blip of lightning. The sun must surely have set, and the clouds were thick. And for the first time since Bailey had left Earth, he was alone. 64. Alone. He had been too ill, too beside himself to make proper sense. Even now he found himself struggling to understand what it was he should have done and would have done if he had had room in his tottering mind for more than the one thought that Daniil must leave. For instance, he had not asked where he now was, what he was near, where Daniil and Giscard were planning to go. He did not know how any portion of the grounded airfoil worked. He could not, of course, make it move, but he might have had it supply heat if he felt cold, or turn off the heat if there were too much, except that he did not know how to direct the machine to do either. He did not know how to opacify the windows if he wanted to be enclosed, or how to open a door if he wanted to leave. The only thing he could do now was to wait for Giscard to come back for him. Surely that was what Giscard would expect him to do. The orders to him had simply been, "Come back for me." There had been no indication that Bailey would change position in any way, and Giscard's clear and uncluttered mind would surely interpret the "come back" with the assumption that he was to come back to the airfoil. Bailey tried to adjust himself to that. In a way, it was a relief, merely to wait, to have to make no decisions for a while, because there were no decisions he could possibly make. It was a relief to be steady and to feel at rest and to be rid of the terrible light flashes and the disturbing crashes of sound. Perhaps he might even allow himself to go to sleep. And then he stiffened. Dare he do that? They were being pursued. They were under observation. The airfoil, while parked and waiting for them outside the administration building of the Robotics Institute, had been tampered with, and no doubt the tamperers would soon be upon him. He was waiting for them, too, and not for Giscard only. Had he thought it out clearly in the midst of his misery? The machine had been tampered with outside the administration building. That might have been done by anyone, but most likely by someone who knew it was there. And who would know that better than Amadeiro? Amadeiro had intended delay until after the storm. That was obvious. He was to travel in the storm, and he was to break down in the storm. Amadeiro had studied Earth and its population. He boasted of that. He would know quite clearly just what difficulty Earth people would have with the outside generally, and with a thunderstorm in particular. He would be quite certain that Bailey would be reduced to complete helplessness. But why should he want that? To bring Bailey back to the Institute? He had already had him. But he had had a Bailey in the full possession of his faculties, and along with him, he had had two robots perfectly capable of defending Bailey physically. It would be different now. If the airfoil were disabled in a storm, Bailey would be disabled emotionally. He would even be unconscious, perhaps, and would certainly not be able to resist being brought back. Nor would the two robots object. With Bailey clearly ill, their only appropriate reaction would be to assist Amadiro's robots in rescuing him. In fact, the two robots would have to come along with Bailey and would do so helplessly. And if anyone ever questioned Amadiro's action, he could say that he had feared for Bailey in the storm, that he had tried to keep him at the Institute and failed, that he had sent his robots to trail him and assure his safety, and that when the airfoil came to grief in the storm, those robots brought Bailey back to Haven. Unless people understood that it had been Amadiro who had ordered the airfoil tampered with, and who would believe that, and how could one prove it? The only possible public reaction would be to praise Amadiro for his humanitarian feelings, all the more astonishing for having been expressed toward a subhuman Earthman. And what would Amadiro do with Bailey then? Nothing, except to keep him quiet and helpless for a time. Bailey was not himself the quarry. That was the point. Amadiro would also have two robots, and they would now be helpless. Their instructions forced them, in the strongest manner, to guard Bailey. And if Bailey were ill and being cared for, they could only follow Amadiro's orders if those orders were clearly and apparently for Bailey's benefit. Nor would Bailey be, perhaps, sufficiently himself to protect them with further orders. Certainly not if he were kept under sedation. It was clear. Amadiro had Bailey, Daniil, and Giscard, but in unusable fashion. He had sent them out into the storm in order to bring them back and have them again in usable fashion. Especially Daniil. It was Daniil who was the key. To be sure, Fastolf would be searching for them eventually and would find them, too, and retrieve them, but by then it would be too late, wouldn't it? And what did Amadiro want with Daniil? Bailey, his head aching, was sure he knew, but how could he possibly prove it? He could think no more. If he could opacify the windows, he could make a little interior world again, enclosed and motionless, and then maybe he could continue his thoughts. But he did not know how to opacify the windows. He could only sit there and look at the flagging storm beyond those windows, hear the whip of rain against the windows, watch the fading lightning, and listen to the muttering thunder. He closed his eyes tightly. The eyelids made a wall, too, but he dared not sleep. The car door on his right opened. He heard the sighing noise it made. He felt the cool, damp breeze enter, the temperature drop, the sharp smell of things green and wet enter and drown out the faint and friendly smell of oil and upholstery that reminded him somehow of the city that he wondered if he would ever see again. He opened his eyes, and there was the odd sensation of a robotic face staring at him, and drifting sideways, yet not really moving. Bailey felt dizzy. The robot, seen as a darker shadow against the darkness, seemed a large one. He had somehow an air of capability about him. He said, "Your pardon, sir. Did you not have the company of two robots?"
"Gone,"
muttered Bailey, acting as ill as he could, and aware that it did not require acting. A brighter flash of the heavens made its way through the eyelids that were now half open.
"Gone? Gone where, sir?"
And then, as he waited for an answer, he said, "Are you ill, sir?" Bailey felt a distant twinge of satisfaction within the inner scrap of himself that was still capable of thinking. If the robot had been without special instruction, he would have responded to Bailey's clear signs of illness before doing anything else. To have asked first about the robots implied hard and close-pressed directions as to their importance. It fit. He tried to assume a strength and normality he did not possess, and said, "I am well. Don't concern yourself with me." It could not possibly have convinced an ordinary robot, but this one had been so intensified in connection with Daniil, obviously, that he accepted it. He said, "Where have the robots gone, sir?"
"Back to the Robotics Institute."
"To the Institute? Why, sir?"
"They were called by Master Roboticist Amadiro, and he ordered them to return. I am waiting for them."
"But why did you not go with them, sir?"
"Master Roboticist Amadiro did not wish me to be exposed to the storm. He ordered me to wait here. I am following Master Roboticist Amadiro's orders."
He hoped the repetition of the prestige-filled name, with the inclusion of the honorific, together with the repetition of the word order, would have its effect on the robot and persuade him to leave Bailey where he was. On the other hand, if they had been instructed with particular care to bring back Daniil, and if they were convinced that Daniil was already on his way back to the Institute, there would be a decline in the intensity of their need in connection with that robot. They would have time to think of Bailey again. They would say, the robot said, "But it appears you are not well, sir." Bailey felt another twinge of satisfaction. He said, "I am well." Behind the robot, he could vaguely see a crowding of several other robots. He could not count them, with their faces gleaming in the occasional lightning flash. As Bailey's eyes adapted to the return of darkness, he could see the dim shine of their eyes. He turned his head. There were robots at the left door, too, though that remained closed. How many had Amadeiro sent? Were they to have been returned by force, if necessary? He said, "Master roboticist Amadeiro's orders were that my robots were to return to the Institute and I was to wait. You see that they are returning and that I am waiting. If you were sent to help, if you have a vehicle, find the robots, who are on their way back, and transport them. This airfoil is no longer operative." He tried to say it all without hesitation and firmly, as a well man would. He did not entirely succeed. "They have returned on foot, sir?" Bailey said, "Find them. Your orders are clear." There was hesitation. Clear hesitation. Bailey finally remembered to move his right foot, he hoped, properly. He should have done it before, but his physical body was not responding properly to his thoughts. Still, the robots hesitated, and Bailey grieved over that. He was not a spacer. He did not know the proper words, the proper tone, the proper air with which to handle robots with the proper efficiency. A skilled roboticist could, with a gesture, a lift of an eyebrow, direct a robot as though it were a marionette of which he held the strings, especially if the robot were of his own design. But Bailey was only an Earthman. He frowned, that was easy to do in his misery, and whispered a weary, "Go," and motioned with his hands. Perhaps that added the last small and necessary quantity of weight to his order, or perhaps an end had simply been reached to the time it took for the robot's positronic pathways to determine, by voltage and counter-voltage, how to sort out their instructions according to the three laws. Either way, they had made up their minds, and after that there was no further hesitation. They moved back to their vehicle, whatever and wherever it was, with such determined speed that they seemed simply to disappear. The door the robot had held open now closed of its own accord. Bailey had moved his foot in order to place it in the pathway of the closing door. He wondered distantly if his foot would be cut off cleanly, or if its bones would be crushed. But he didn't move it. Surely no vehicle would be designed to make such a misadventure possible. He was alone again. He had forced robots to leave a patently unwell human being by playing on the force of the orders given them by a competent robot master who had been intent on strengthening the second law for his own purposes, and had done it to the point where Bailey's own quite apparent lies had subordinated the first law to it. How well he had done it, Bailey thought, with distant self-satisfaction, and became aware that the door which had swung shut was still ajar, held so by his foot, and that that foot had not been the least bit damaged as a result.